From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Will President Obama say yes or no to the Keystone XL pipeline? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A State Department report on piping oil from Canadian tar sands to North Dakota downplays the impact on global warming. But it's just uncertain enough to add fuel to both sides. Republicans see a green light for energy independence. Environmentalists warn of climate disaster. Democrats are divided, with the president caught in the middle, and control of the Senate might be at stake. Where would the pipeline go? Who would be affected along the route? How has it come to symbolize the conflict between global warming and the economy? Today's talking point, Facebook on its 10th anniversary. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Oil pipelines are laid down every day, but the one called Keystone XL has become a test of President Obama's environmental legacy. What are the possible consequences for climate change and the economy? Will he make a decision before the midterm elections? Could that determine who controls the Senate? Today's talking point, Facebook turns 10 today. Mark Zuckerberg is a ripe old 29. We'll hear what he has in mind for the site visited by half the world's online users. First, this news update, Microsoft has appointed a new CEO who will try to keep the tech behemoth relevant in a fast-moving world. Satya Nadella was born in Hyderabad, India. He's been with Microsoft since 1992.
In a software-powered world, what's a better place than Microsoft in terms of being able to take all of this human potential that we have in the 130,000 people, and apply it to a world that's rapidly becoming more software-driven.
Jonathan Krim is technology editor for The Wall Street Journal. Good to have you on our program.
How are you?
Why is this big news?
Well, look, Microsoft is still a very big company. There have only really been two CEOs in its history. And it's a company that has missed some of the biggest waves of innovation, but is still deeply embedded in particularly corporate America, as well as 90% of all of the desktops and laptops that are in use today. So it's still a very important company. It's a huge company. And it's going to be very interesting to see what Mr. Nadella decides to do.
So the other two CEOs, of course, have been Bill Gates. Who's being replaced by Mr. Nadella?
Well, Steve Ballmer is stepping down. He had been the leader since around 2000 when Bill Gates went off to do mostly his foundation work. And Steve decided in August of last year that it was time for him to move on after what was pretty clearly a push from the board of directors. There's definitely a sense that Microsoft needs to get its engines recharged.
Why is it then that Mr. Nadella is the choice?
Well, they looked quite a lot at several outsiders as well as insiders. I think what we're seeing is a company that is taking a fairly safe choice. They could have gone with a visionary outsider who was going to really shake up Microsoft's culture and strategy. They've opted instead to keep going on generally the course that they have been on, and it's been very successful from a revenue standpoint. This is a company that made $77 billion in revenue in 2013. So they're not looking for a revolution, clearly, but there are some inside Microsoft who believe that Mr. Nadella is capable of bringing some change.
He has been in charge of a department called Cloud and Enterprise. What is that?
Well, this is sort of the newest and biggest thing in corporate computing. Everyone's data and storage is now moving rapidly to the cloud. You don't need to have massive servers on your site or rented in a physical location close to you. It is much more run by web services companies. Amazon has come in and very much shaken up the space. And Microsoft has to be a player in that arena, or it will very quickly lose its connection to the front-end software that they primarily sell to companies.
We can't complete this conversation without talking about Bill Gates, because he has now, after focusing pretty much on philanthropy, as you indicated, decided that he is coming back to play a different kind of role. What will it be?
Well, this is, I think, among the most interesting storylines right now, and one that we're working on very hard for publication very soon. But it appears that he really is coming back to be a very close advisor to Mr. Nadella. Mr. Nadella seems to have embraced that. You know, Bill was the founder of this company and the genius behind it. He's been a little bit more disconnected from modern web and computing businesses over the last few years, but he has been working to get better plugged in and better in touch of late. And now we're just sort of waiting to see whether he's going to take a really active role or be much more of an advisor.
Microsoft once was ahead of its time. Can it be cool again?
Very good question. I don't know the answer. I think they have to try. But they also have, as I said, an extremely prosperous corporate enterprise computing business. They're going to need to keep ahead on that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to create a lot of buzz on the consumer side.
On the other hand, with Bill Gates involved, the buzz, as you indicated, certainly in your newspaper, is going to be pretty important.
Absolutely, and everywhere. I mean, he's not only an iconic figure; he's recognized as being one of the smartest brains on the planet, and so it's really going to be fascinating to watch.
Jonathan Krim with The Wall Street Journal, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
In a moment, will President Obama say yes or no to the Keystone XL pipeline? On To The Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Norman Olney back with To The Point. The Keystone XL pipeline would bring oil from Canadian tar sands to North Dakota. There, it would connect to an existing pipeline that runs south to ports on the Gulf Coast of Louisiana. Because it would cross an international border, the State Department was required to file a statement on the environmental impact. And last week, the report came down, running no less than 11 volumes. Steve Mufson has written a Kindle single book called Keystone XL, Down the Line. He's energy correspondent for The Washington Post. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Warren.
11 volumes, that's a lot of words, no doubt. But what people are saying about it is that it pretty much indicates that the Keystone XL pipeline would not make all that much difference with regard to global warming. Is that a fair summary?
It's sort of a fair summary. They've tried to make it as complicated as possible. The reason they say that is because they say that whether or not we built the Keystone Pipeline, development of the oil sands would continue at the same pace. And then it lays out a lot of reasons why it thinks that. And, you know, reasonable people could come to different conclusions about that. And I think that's one reason why this report still leaves a lot of room for Kerry and Obama to make any decision they really want to make.
Kerry, of course, the Secretary of State, former senator, concerned about his environmental credentials, as is the president. Why does he still have to make a call on this? Why doesn't it just go directly to the president?
Well, it could go directly to the president, but generally the way the process was set up under, I believe, an executive order, the decision is to be made by the Secretary of State or anyone he deputizes. So he could actually be done by the Deputy Secretary of State, but John Kerry's indicated that he very much wants to be involved in making this decision.
Okay, we'll talk about that and about the politics of it in particular as we go along. But first, let me ask you about this. In your book, Keystone XL Down the Line, you describe going all the way from where the Canadian tar sands themselves are being developed to the end of the pipeline, some of which is already built. What did you find along the way? What's it like?
Well, what we found is that there are a lot of different... Well, first of all, most of it's pretty empty. I mean, they tried to build the pipeline in places where they wouldn't be going, you know, you're not going through cities and things like that. So we went through a lot of old oil boom and bust towns, a lot of the Great Plains where there aren't that many people living. What we found partly is that while the issue, the big issue about the pipeline is a climate issue, as you go down the line, you run into a lot of people who have a lot of other concerns, whether it's the risk of a leak in the pipeline affecting water supplies, whether it's the process of eminent domain, through which TransCanada has been able to force American farmers and ranchers to let them come onto their property and bury a pipeline. Other people worried about the big Ogallala Aquifer. Native Americans worried about old tribal sacred sites and burial grounds. So there were a lot of parochial issues that cut both ways. You know, there's a strong prairie populism in Nebraska that cuts across party lines. And so you really have a tremendous coalition of people who are opposing this pipeline for a whole variety of reasons at this point.
So that appears then to be why a pipeline, which isn't really all that long, has come to be so controversial. But what about the question of a global warming, and how certain is the report about the claim that the oil sands would continue to be developed, whether the pipeline was built or not?
Well, on the climate issue, there are a couple of key facts that the report lays out that are important to keep in mind. One is that the process of extracting the oil sands is energy intensive. You basically, you know, it's oil trapped in the sands and clay. You have to add a lot of hot water and essentially melt it so that to get this very thick, gooey bitumen out, which is what you're sending through the pipeline. That oil is, because of the energy-intensive nature of extracting it, contributes about 17% more greenhouse gases than the average barrel of oil used in the United States. Now, some of the oil this is going to displace is also heavy oil, like the oil that comes from Venezuela, but it's still 2 to 10% more greenhouse gas intensive than that oil. But on the other hand, there's the question of rail, because if the pipeline's not built, the State Department report says producers will be more likely to ship their oil out by rail. And using railroads as opposed to pipelines is, the report says, 28 to 42% more greenhouse gas emissions than the pipeline would involve. So you have a kind of factors on both sides there on the climate issue. Of course, people who are opposed to the pipeline say that the producers can't possibly get enough capacity through railroads, and blocking the pipeline will either slow or block or impede the development of the tar sands. That would be a better thing for the world overall.
And there has been a lot of transportation of oil via rail that has led to a lot of accidents recently.
Sure. I mean, it's almost as though the pipeline companies have couldn't have timed it better. You know, there's just been a real spate of railroad accidents in the past 8 months, the most serious being that awful one in eastern Canada where a lt of people were killed. But there was a small accident, a derailment in Philadelphia, and although no one was injured and nothing really leaked, it was a reminder to people in urban areas that there are oil tank shipments even in urban areas. So a lot of concern on that front.
Just describe briefly, if you will, what it looks like where the tar sands are, in fact, being mined. I gather that's the appropriate term.
Yeah, it is, and it's quite a sight. You know, Alberta is vast, just extraordinarily vast, and most of it's covered by this thick, really beautiful boreal forest, which has grown up on land that is primarily wetlands. Now, the oil is trapped not in a kind of reservoir of the sort that we're used to tapping, which is basically, you know, more or less a pool trapped in various rock formations. This is basically oil that's spread out not too far below the surface. And so the companies have to cut down the trees, strip them back. They peel back the peat and wetlands, and then they essentially strip mine the rest of it. That's about half of it. There is another half of the operations in which they do inject steam underground to melt the sands underground and then suck it up through other pipes. That doesn't look quite so awful. There are still cuts through the forest to get to all these things, but it's also very energy intensive, and so it's a awe-inspiring and not necessarily the best sense of the word sight, and it's going to keep growing. Part of it is that when you have the waste after taking the oil out, you dump that waste in ponds, and those are also unsightly.
And the scale of it apparently, I gather, is just enormous. You talk about trucks the size of houses.
Yes, I mean the trucks are humongous. We saw some very hulking guys who came up about halfway up the tires of these trucks.
Again, Steve,
there is some restoration going on, but it's going on at a very slow pace. And you can restore a lot of trees, but you can't really restore wetlands that easily. And so they're not really leaving the same scene behind as they came, as was there when the oil companies came. Even if they do make very big efforts.
Stephen Mufson, the energy correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the Kindle single Keystone XL Down the Line. Michael Brune is executive director of the Sierra Club. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. You already have started actions in opposition to this report and to the pressure on the president now from the Republicans in particular to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. The public comment actually begins tomorrow. How optimistic are you that the president's going to go your way and decree that it not be built?
Yeah, we certainly think that the pipeline shouldn't be built, and we think that development in the tar sands should be curtailed. So that's why yesterday you saw more than 300 different demonstrations all across the country. More than 10,000 people spontaneously took part in this, even though the department, the analysis that came from the State Department was just a couple days earlier. What we see is that people across the country, Sierra Club members and many, many more people, are looking at this decision as it's not just a decision about a pipeline, and it's not even just a decision about the tar sands. It's about the future of our country and the future of our energy policy. We know that as a country, we have relied on oil as well as coal and gas for well more than a century. We know that oil powers much of the economy, but we also know that the threat of climate disruption is severe. Here in California, we're facing the worst drought ever recorded, a drought that may be worse than anything we've experienced in more than 500 years. We're seeing extreme weather events take place all across the country at the same time when clean energy is becoming more cheap. So the fundamental question here is it better for us as a country to put billions of dollars into a pipeline that would increase the amount of development coming from the tar sands, which is more toxic, more difficult to clean up, more corrosive, more carbon intensive than conventional oil? Or should we realize that we have to get off dirty fuels? We have to find a way to rapidly transition towards clean energy, towards electric vehicles, towards advanced batteries, towards energy efficiency, so that we can have a modern, affluent, prosperous society that doesn't pollute our air and our water and destabilize our climate simply to produce energy.
Michael Brune, again, executive director of the Sierra Club. Here is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, in a news conference he had with other Republican leaders.
Look, we need jobs and we want energy security. And the Keystone Pipeline is critical to both of them. There's bipartisan support for this project in both the House and the Senate. Listen, I recognize the president has friends that are opposed to this. But if we're going to operate our government on sound science, it's time for the president to act.
So, Michael Brune, back to you. Is it sound science to say that, in fact, this portion of the pipeline, which isn't really all that much of the pipeline, isn't going to make all that much difference to all of the issues that you raised having to do with climate change? Is this more symbolic than real?
No. No, this is very real. And so at the heart of this debate is the idea that tar sands development will happen no matter what. Right? That was, as Stephen said, the fundamental underlying assumption that was part of the State Department's report. And groups like the Sierra Club and many others believe that the only way in which we're going to meet the challenge of climate change is to begin to keep the most carbon-intensive, the dirtiest fuels on the planet, underground, where they're not extracted. In fact, the world's best climate scientists are saying that if we want to limit runaway climate change, we have to keep two-thirds of all of the oil and coal and gas that we've already identified underground. It can't be extracted. So any common sense approach to this would say, let's start with the dirtiest. Let's make sure that we're not building out infrastructure to rapidly expand those reserves that are the most carbon intensive and the most dirty, which is what the tar sands represents. Let me just say one quick thing, which is that I do agree with what Representative Boehner said at the beginning of his little clip there. We do need jobs, and we do need energy security. What we don't have to do is sacrifice our climate to get that. We can create many more jobs in clean energy that would be found in this individual pipeline, and we can create energy security when we harvest to a greater degree the solar energy that falls on rooftops all across the country, the wind that's ripping through the Midwest. In fact, this is the very trail of where this pipeline would go, the wind that's bouncing offshores, and the energy efficiency that is inherent in our buildings across the country. So we can meet our energy challenge. We can put a lot of people to work, but we don't have to dig up the dirtiest oil on the planet in order to do it.
Michael Brune, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Brigham McCown is with us, first acting administrator of PHMSA. That's the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. He had that position under George W. Bush. He was appointed by a cabinet member who was a Democrat, former Congressman Norm Mineta. He now heads the National Infrastructure Safety Foundation. That's a nonprofit geared toward ensuring the safety of all infrastructure, as the name would suggest. Brigham McCown, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me on.
Is there, do you think, an argument for building this pipeline, or, as Michael Brune suggests, is it time to stop?
Well, I think we have to separate the climate agenda from an infrastructure project. And the truth is, whether we like it or not, the tar sands in Alberta are that country's number one economic driver. They're developing them, and the oil will be sold. It'll be sold to us, or it'll be sold to China. In fact, Canada just approved a major pipeline to the West Coast, where it will be exported. So, you know, I understand the desire to lessen our burden by using hydrocarbons, but you know, frankly, the oil is already getting to market. And so as a former regulator, my perspective is let's make sure that it gets from point A to B as safely as possible.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you to hold that thought because we need to take a break. But I wanted to get that in before we did. We'll come back. We'll hear more from you and our other guests as well on our talking point later, Facebook's 10th birthday. We'll hear what Mark Zuckerberg has in mind for the future. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about the Keystone XL pipeline, which President Obama, first Secretary of State to Kerry, but then President Obama has to decide whether or not to approve because it crosses an international boundary. They have that responsibility. And it would take oil mined from the Canadian tar sands across the border into North Dakota to connect with a pipe that has already been built. We're talking now with Brigham McCown with the National Infrastructure Safety Foundation. What I understand you to be saying is that it would be safer to do it with the Keystone XL pipeline than it would by other means. But why do we want to let Canada go ahead, even though tar sands are the major driver of their economy, if in fact the consequences for the environment are as dire as we heard from Michael Bruin of the Sierra Club?
Well, I'm not sure they are that dire. In fact, the State Department says that Keystone will have little or no bearing on the crude oil market, and that the report found that greenhouse gas emissions are unlikely to change significantly if the pipeline is built. And when you consider other transportation modes that will carry the pipeline, whether they be rail or truck or crude oil tankers, you will actually increase greenhouse gas emissions. So from that perspective, you know, you've heard, Warren, where there's a will, there's a way. This oil is going to find its way to market. And when you compare not only the heavier crudes from the Mideast and other OPEC countries, but when you factor in the transportation of that over to the U.S., you know, there really isn't a greenhouse gas disaster. And, you know, the opponents of the pipeline project have sort of confused the safety of the pipeline project with this bigger question on fossil fuels. But, you know, frankly, the oil is coming to market. So, again, it makes the most amount of sense to put it on a brand-new state-of-the-art pipeline. That's the safest way, the least expensive way, the most reliable way, and it actually results in the fewest greenhouse gas emissions.
So, Michael Bruin, again, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, why isn't it you're supporting what Brigham McCown seems to be calling the best of what may be a bunch of bad choices?
Well, there's two reasons. One, first, I don't believe that what Brigham is saying is true. His underlying assumption, as he said, is that this oil is going to come out and it's going to get to market somehow. And you don't have to believe the Sierra Club on this if you don't want to. Just look at what the oil industry is saying. There are more than a dozen instances where you have executives for oil companies up in Canada, refining executives down in the Gulf who would take this oil and export most of it, by the way, and industry analysts, banking analysts, and they all say that the only way for this industry to grow is if there's additional export capacity. And in fact, they say if this pipeline isn't built, there will be a significant constriction and it'll impede the ability for the industry to grow. You can also look at markets. Foreign investment in tar sands development has plummeted from about $20 billion to down to $2 billion in 2013. So we're seeing already, because of the delays in the Keystone XL pipeline, what's being called into question is whether or not the industry can expand and can continue to grow.
Isn't there also, Brigham McCown, a concern about the price of oil and that if it continues to drop and to be replaced by natural gas, that then it wouldn't be worth developing the tar sands in the first place?
Well, you know, the tar sands development, at least any of the oil that comes into the U.S., first of all, it can't be exported without an export license. So that is unlikely to happen in the current climate. But B, world energy demand is going to continue to increase through the next several decades. And even by 2040, you know, all reports say that renewables are still going to be a small fraction of our overall energy consumption. So the appetite for fossil fuels is going to remain. And so I think it unlikely that this oil would stay in the ground. Although, Warren, let me say that transitioning to natural gas is a great benefit for the country because it has, you know, half the carbon emissions of coal, and there's no reason, frankly, why fleet vehicles can't transition over to natural gas from gasoline or diesel as well.
Again, Brigham McCown is now head of the National Infrastructure Safety Foundation. Darren Goode is with us, senior energy and environmental reporter for Politico and Politico Pro. Good to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren. Thanks for having me.
All this at some point comes down to a decision by the President of the United States, but it will have significant political ramifications. Let's elaborate a bit on that, and very particularly the split within the Democratic Party. We heard what the Republicans are thinking, as expressed by Speaker Boehner, but what about those Democrats that live in oil states?
Yeah, you do have some of them certainly that for a long time have been calling for the pipeline to be approved, and they're certainly saying that even more so now. You know, it's interesting about the analysis that came out on Friday, it is a little bit more nuanced than we've seen in the past. There's enough for both sides to kind of pick apart and use. But really, the arguments haven't changed very much, and they've just been amped up. And there was a press conference today where Democrats like Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Mark Begich of Alaska, joined Republicans and others in calling for this pipeline to be approved and pointed at Friday's analysis as a reason. Now, Landrieu, Begich, and others from oil states are among some of the more vulnerable Senate Democrats that are running for re-election. The president, of course, wants to try to help Democrats keep control of the Senate. The Senate has been used as a firewall against House Republican efforts to try to undermine aspects of his plans, his agenda. And there's very little chance for, I think, for Democrats to take hold of the House. And so really it's up to the Senate to try to keep things from getting to his way that Republicans are trying to do. So you kind of have that dilemma here where if he were to reject the pipeline before voters go to the polls, how does that affect these senators? Can they distance themselves enough from that where it doesn't really hurt them, or does it undermine them?
What about the concern about legacy, not just on the part of the president, but also on the part of John Kerry?
Yeah, and that's an argument that the opponents of the pipeline, that's certainly what they're saying even more vigorously now. They're stressing that the decision is still on the shoulders of the president, still on the shoulders of Secretary Kerry, both of which groups like Sierra Club and others, they view them as champions for climate change. And especially now that the president released his climate agenda last summer, but their argument is that legacy, that climate legacy, would be significantly undermined if he approves this project. And that argument is still resonating. As Michael mentioned, they've had events here in D.C. and elsewhere this week. Those are going to continue. And that mantra of, Mr. President, this is your decision. It doesn't matter what the State Department says. This is really on you. You've got a climate legacy that you know that you want to create here. This is going to really destroy that if you do this.
So there's a lot of pressure, obviously, then, on the president coming from both sides. What about the timing? Does he have any kind of deadline by which time he has to have made the call?
There is no deadline. As you mentioned, there's a public comment period that starts tomorrow. Once that's over, really there is no standard, there is no set timeline for Secretary Kerry or the president to make any more moves on this. It's interestingly, you know, in Congress, the one thing that Congress has been able to do so far was to set a specific timeline for the president to act a couple of years ago. He did. He said, no, I want more study. I want more analysis. That's what you saw released on Friday. Now, after this public comment period, especially, I could very well, I would expect to see certainly another effort, probably in the Senate, maybe starting off there, just because the House can do whatever it wants. But the Senate, it's a lot more difficult to get anything through. I can certainly see an effort over there, bipartisan effort over there, to try to set another timeline for the president to make up his mind on this. That would be much easier for them to do than to, say, pass something that says you have to approve this, but only something saying, look, you have to make a decision by this timeline, this date. That could be part of these upcoming debt ceiling talks, or it could be later.
Darren Good, again, a senior energy and environmental reporter for Politico and Politico Pro. Brigham McGowan, back to you. Are there reasons that the oil industry needs to have this decision sooner rather than later?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the oil is shifting to other mediums. And one of the things I should point out about Keystone XL is that northern 852 miles will go right through the U.S. Bakken area. And that pipeline is designated to carry up to 25% capacity to carry U.S. crude oil. Because that's not happening, what we're seeing is a fourfold increase in crude oil by rail. And we have seen several incidents as of late with rail. So what the denial of Keystone is doing is, in essence, forcing oil onto other transportation modes. And that's one of the things the State Department addressed by way of safety as well.
So that is true then, even if it isn't all focused on Canadian tar sands, other oil would be traveling through this pipeline? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. That, you know, TransCanada has set aside up to 25% of its line capacity for U.S. Bakken crude oil. And now, that won't be able to eliminate shipments by barge or rail or truck, but it would certainly ease the bottleneck out of the U.S. Bakken.
Michael Bruin, back to you with the Sierra Club. Would you like to see the president wait, particularly given the potential consequences for Democratic control of the Senate?
You know, I think that the consequences are limited to just a senator or two. I don't think Begich would be impacted by this at all up in Alaska, or his race. I don't think it would be impacted by it. His race is going to be impacted by Alaskan issues, and as it relates to the environment, it's much more related to the Arctic.
You don't buy the idea then that control of the Senate might depend on the decision with regard to the Keystone XL pipeline?
No. There's not a single poll in any of these races that says that Keystone XL, if it goes one way or the other, will be a major determining factor in how voters will actually vote. So I think that that's a distraction. I do think the president should make a decision. I think he should make it quickly. But I think that anybody who asserts that this will have a major impact on an individual race and thus should be delayed, I just don't think that that really is borne out by the facts.
Darren Good, back to you. When we're talking about politics, a lot of politicians have their fingers in the wind. What do the polls show that American public opinion feels about this?
You look at Pew Research and a couple of others, and, you know, these are, I'm talking about polls that have not been funded by any one side. Generally speaking, the ones that I have seen, that I've noticed, have shown pretty good size support for it. We're talking about anywhere between maybe 60% to 70%. I know that Michael and others that are opposed to this, say that if people know the facts a little bit more, perhaps their opinion would be swayed on that. And that's kind of a problem here, where I don't know how deep into this debate people are getting. I mean, most people's opinions may very well be just kind of on the surface. They may buy kind of the simple argument that we need oil still, we need to import it still, so we might as well get it from Canada rather than from the Middle East or somewhere else. So some of that perhaps simplistic arguments might be driving this debate. We'll see whether or not the more this goes on. I mean, certainly it's been going on now for a long time, but the more this continues to heat up, will be interesting to see whether public stance on this gets a little bit more nuanced or not.
Okay, we're running short of time, but Michael Bruin, I want to go back to you. One of the things the State Department report says is that $3.4 billion would be added to the U.S. economy if, in fact, the Keystone XL pipeline were built. How do you argue against that?
Well, of course, it's a big pipeline, and it would put some people to work. The question is whether or not it's the best investment to make in our economy. For the same dollar investment, we can create a whole lot more jobs in the clean energy sector without threatening our air and water and our climate. And I think what's needed in this debate is to compare what's the best future, what's the best investment in our future. And what is needed in this is also a sense of optimism, because over the last couple years, the amount of oil that Americans consume has dropped from about 22 million barrels of oil per day to below 19. Over the next few years, it'll go to below 15 million barrels of oil per day. So our economy is growing, and we're using a lot less oil. At the same time, that clean energy and advanced batteries are growing dramatically. So we do have an opportunity right now to begin to shift, and to shift with growing momentum away from dirty fuels like we're seeing up in the tar sands or even up in the Arctic, and towards clean energy that puts more people to work and provides energy security in a way that doesn't degrade the environment.
So, Brigham McCown, you applauded the change to natural gas. What about renewables? And is there an industry there that needs more government support in order to contribute more to the economy so that we can get off fossil fuels altogether?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there are several different forms of renewables, and frankly, we need them all. And one of the things that is long overdue in this country is revisiting our energy policy. And, you know, frankly, it's remained unchanged since the 73 Arab oil embargo. And that's the conversation we ought to be having, and we should be investing. But by the same token, I do want to point out that the pipeline is private investment. It's not government investment. So a little bit of difference in the pots of money here. But ultimately, we need to keep heading the direction we're heading, but we also have to make sure that we have a stable supply of fuel that we can safely get from point A to B.
And quickly, Steve Mufson, our first guest, energy correspondent with The Washington Post, author of the Kindle single, Keystone XL, Down the Line. It's really all about the national interest. How do we determine that?
Well, the national interest is a combination of, you know, reasonable energy prices and you know, within the bounds of what we think we can do without endangering the climate. I mean, I think one of the things that I come away from this thinking is really how important energy efficiency is. I think that the raising of fuel standards by the president was the most important piece of both energy and climate policy he made that will have a more impact than all the renewables have had in terms of oil consumption, because oil is primarily transportation, and it's going to be a long time before we have enough electric cars to be able to have them make a meaningful impact on our overall automobile fleet. So, you know, using less of it seems like a good idea, because no matter where we drill, there are problems. You know, drilling off the Chukchi Sea, 10,000 holes in the state of North Dakota. All of these things are fraught with environmental issues.
Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. Once again, the president has a decision to make. There will be public comments starting tomorrow, 30 days of that. No deadline as far as the president is concerned, but there are eight other agencies that may have to be consulted about this, including the EPA. We'll follow it and see what happens. Stephen Mufson, again, with The Washington Post. Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club. Brigham McCown with the National Infrastructure Safety Foundation. And Darren Goode with Politico and Politico Pro. Thank you all very much for being with us today. Facebook turns 10 years old today with a value of $135 billion and 1.23 billion users. We'll hear what they like and don't like about Facebook itself and what Mark Zuckerberg is thinking about the future. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
We're not only back with today's talking point. Facebook is 10 years old today. Mark Zuckerberg will turn 30 in May. He sets himself specific goals every year, and this year he intends to write at least one well-considered thank you note every day. That's according to a cover story in Bloomberg Business Week, co-authored by Brad Stone. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thank you.
Of course. One of the things it says on the cover is that you talk about Mark Zuckerberg, or he talks, rather, about getting through the awkward phase. What does that mean?
Well, I think our cover line was Facebook hits puberty, which, of course, I don't get to write the covers. But, you know, I think it's accurate in a way. You know, Facebook just announced an almost blockbuster earnings report, 25% of revenue growth, added 170 million monthly active users over the year. That's like two-thirds of a Twitter right there. But the big thing was that they've really completed the shift to mobile. So as you remember, when they went public, it was a big worry. You know, did this company even understand mobile? And now most of their revenues come from it. So, they've kind of stabilized and addressed some of the big issues that the investors and even some users had with it.
Tell us a little more about Mark Zuckerberg, and particularly these annual goals that he sets for himself. What are some of the others?
Yeah, this is an interesting character quirk. So over the years, and I've talked to him a number of times, I always try to ask him what his annual goal is. One year it was coding every day. One year it was trying to meet someone new, someone not a Facebook employee every day. And of course, the big one that made news a couple of years ago, where he said that every time he ate meat, he wanted to kill the animal himself, and it was a kind of a way to I guess, feel the social responsibility for eating meat. And then this year, when I asked him, he said, you know, he felt really a lot of gratitude towards his position in life and the success that he's had and that Facebook has had. And so he resolved to, yeah, write that thank you note either over email or long form every single day.
Does he seem to be a man who is at the age of almost 30, comfortable with himself?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the early years, and any journalist covering Facebook would probably have these stories, but he was, you know, he wasn't the greatest spokesman for the company. He was awkward talking publicly. You know, he tended to repeat in a robotic monotone that his mission was to make the world more open and connected. And now, look, I mean, as with all things and all aspects of the job, he's gotten better, even though he's still in his 20s. And, you know, he's much more personable and much more, I think, in touch with, you know, what we want to hear. And he provided this vision of doing more apps for smartphones and connecting billions of people around the world that aren't on the internet today. So, yeah, he's evolved quite a bit.
Apparently they had a hackathon at Facebook, which he presided over, that lasted for several days. What's a hackathon, and who else participated?
Right. That's when, you know, the engineers, the programmers of the company get together to basically just brainstorm by writing code. But this hackathon in December was an interesting one because I think the company realizes it can't continue to kind of shuffle the furniture around on the big social network. There are just too many users. They're too resistant to change. So the new strategy is to do lots of independent, individual apps for smartphones. They released one this week called Paper. It's like a magazine app. And that was the hackathon to just come together and brainstorm new Facebook ideas for phones.
Brad Stone, again, senior writer at Bloomberg Business Week, a co-author of this cover story about Mark Zuckerberg, also author of a book called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. Facebook is the dominant presence on the internet worldwide, and here with some statistics about that is Aaron Smith. He's a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
You have found that one of the reasons that people use Facebook is fear.
Yeah, so actually what we found was that fear is actually something that people don't really mind so much. And in the context of this particular piece of research, it was fear of missing out on social activities. So people seeing photos or other information about social events that they weren't invited to. In the context of all of the things that people might have problems with about Facebook, that actually didn't really rise to the top. In fact, it was the very lowest thing on the list that we asked about.
What do people strongly dislike?
What they tend to dislike, and as you know, might imagine, if when you get all of your friends in one virtual room, you tend to have some sources of friction and drama there. And the number one thing that they tend to say that they dislike is people oversharing about themselves. So posting too much, posting information that they didn't really care to see. And the other sort of thing that they gravitated towards was sort of drama amongst their friends. So again, when you get lots of people together who may not have a lot in common sometimes, they can tend to argue with each other and get annoying and so forth. And people tend to be a little bit bothered by that. At the same time, they also recognize that there's lots of valuable things about Facebook in terms of connecting them with lots of people and giving them new sources of support and information about their friends.
So obviously they like it or they wouldn't use it. Does it appear that the number of people using it is going to continue to increase?
Well, we don't know whether it will continue to increase, and certainly in the United States, we find that about 6 out of every 10 adult Americans is now a Facebook user, and that includes the 15% of the public that is not even on the internet in the first place. So certainly when you look at them in the context of the broader social networking universe, they're clearly the top player in terms of numbers and in terms of sort of the engagement of their user base.
So they're not on the internet, they're in mobile, is that right?
Well, and Brad, you know, mentioned the mobile story, and clearly that's one that comes through very clearly in our work, and that's true for Facebook as well as a number of other platforms. But you know, mobile users in general are very different from stationary users, as we call them. They go more places, they do more things, they access more sources of news, and Facebook is certainly no different in that regard.
Aaron Smith, senior researcher for the Pew Research Center. Brad Stone, back to you with Bloomberg Business Week. Did you talk to Zuckerberg about any of these issues that people raise about people oversharing and things of that kind?
No. No, you know, I don't think in Mark's mental model there's that much of a phenomenon called oversharing. You know, he wants people to share more. Although we did talk about it in this way. You know, I really asked him. He had such a faith in real identity, people using their real names. And, you know, there are a lot of questions about teenagers and how they are, increasingly guarded on Facebook and turn into other social networks like Snapchat, where they could use anonymously or with pseudonyms. And I think he finally understands that. And he said, and some of the new apps or services for phones that they'll be announcing over the next few years, that he wants to allow people to use pseudonyms. That is a big shift for Facebook. I think he just kind of realizes that, you know, people want to, they don't necessarily want to share with a big group of people that might include their parents or their teachers. They might want to be more guarded.
Aaron Smith, are there people who feel that Facebook is simply too intrusive and that they want to get off it?
Well, certainly what Brad said is something that resonates with a lot of the work we've done among teenagers as well as adults, frankly. And what we see are that people are using Facebook as kind of their baseline social networking platform, but that they're then branching off into other platforms depending on the type of content they're interested in or who they're looking to share it with. So sometimes sharing with their broad Facebook network is inappropriate for whatever reason, so they may branch out into these more private networks. Or if they're particularly interested in news content, for example, and want to follow a breaking story, they may branch off to Twitter for the time being.
Okay.
So certainly we see people supplementing their Facebook use with other social networks in a utilitarian way. But certainly Facebook seems to be the sort of bedrock that people start from and then branch out from there, rather than replacing their Facebook use with something else.
Facebook, 10 years old today. Aaron Smith at the Pew Research Center, Brad Stone with Bloomberg Business Week. Thanks to you both. I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI. Public Radio International.